Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you wouldn't know it from the corporate media, but what may have been the largest prison labor strike in the country's history happened September 9th after months of organizing. Prisoners hope to call attention to a range of complaints about conditions, including forced labor. This country is supposedly taking a bipartisan, fresh look at mass incarceration. So what does elite media's collective yawn say about their actual interest in what happens to people once they're behind bars? We'll hear from investigative journalist and prison radio director Noelle Hanrahan. Also on the show, Wells Fargo being fined once again for fraud. This time it's signing customers up for accounts they didn't ask for in order to meet sales goals. The CEO will supposedly answer questions at a congressional hearing, but is there any sense we're any closer to asking the right questions of the banking industry? Former financial regulator William Black is associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He'll help us sort through the Wells Fargo story. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. The September 6th New York Times featured a profile of Driscoll's, described by reporter Stephanie Strom as the family-owned berry juggernaut. No other company in the world grows berries exactly like these, readers were told. Driscoll's is betting that once consumers know why its berries are distinctive, they will demand them by name, readers were told. The company's YouTube channel will feature stories told by consumers about why berries make them happy. The strawberries trace their heritage to the late 1800s when Aunt Lou came home from a trip with some plants. All of this, readers were told by the New York Times. What readers would have no clue about would be the 3 years of organizing, the walkouts, picket lines, and lawsuits over labor violations, leading to Driscoll's being the subject of a pretty high-profile international boycott. Wage theft, poverty wages, hostile and unhealthy conditions, all of these have been reported. One of the workers' lawsuits went to the Washington State Supreme Court. They won a 2015 decision that ensured paid rest breaks for farm workers statewide. The New York Times story comes with a slideshow in which company owners get a portrait, but farm workers' faces are hidden. Contrast it with the work of labor photojournalist David Bacon, who has profiled Driscoll's farm workers, including Felimon Pineda, vice president of Familias Unidas por la Justicia, the independent union from Washington State. After the Times piece ran, farm workers at major Driscoll supplier Sakuma Brothers Farms voted to join that union, and they've called for a suspension of the boycott. A story in Washington's The Stranger reported on a celebration. It noted a banner that read, "A victory for our children," and another saying, "Respect the people who grow your food." Somebody alert the Times. Well, the drumbeat of Trump as Russian agent probably won't stop until Election Day. Adam Johnson noted that one subgenre of this line of thinking, that Russia will literally hack our election process and throw the U.S. into a dystopian constitutional crisis, appears to be being mainstreamed, due in good part to the Washington Post. A September 5th Post story followed the provocative headline, undermined down the page, formula. Up top, U.S. investigating potential covert Russian plan to disrupt November elections. Five paragraphs down, quote, "The official cautioned that the intelligence community is not saying it has definitive proof of such tampering or any Russian plans to do so," close quote. Well, government officials investigating something, no matter how implausible, could still be said to be newsworthy. But that story was followed 3 days later by an op-ed by Post contributor Ann Applebaum that lists a series of increasingly goofy scenarios in which Russia could spark a U.S. electoral disaster, as the headline has it. One involves Russian hackers breaking into the voting system, which Applebaum says has already happened in Arizona. That's not true. There have been accusations of Russian hacking of voter data in Arizona, but that's separate from the actual voting system you'd need to hack to change vote tallies. If only that slip were the end of it, though. Scenario four is, quote, the Russians attempt to throw the election. They might try to get Trump elected. Alternatively, and this would, of course, be even more devastating, they might try to rig the election for Clinton, perhaps leaving a trail of evidence designed to connect the rigging operation to Clinton's campaign, close quote. So that's a double-layered false flag of election rigging, if you're following. But hang on to your hat for scenario number five. Quote, once revealed, the result will be media hysteria, hearings, legal challenges, mass rallies, a constitutional crisis, followed by confusion, chaos, and an undermining of the office of the presidency. Trump might emerge from the process as president after all. He will then go on, as promised at so many rallies, to lock her up, and of course to open a broad relation with Russian President Vladimir Putin, the only foreign leader he seems to truly admire. Even if Clinton remains as president, she will be tarnished. At least a part of the country will assume she is illegitimate, that the elites and Clinton clan and the mainstream media stole the election from the people, close quote. Well, as Johnson says, it's unclear now whether we're reading real political analysis or a rejected script for 24, but it would be funny if it weren't in the major daily of the nation's capital. Applebaum goes on to say that probably none of this will happen, but that that's not the point because, quote, rumors of election fraud can create the same hysteria as real election fraud, close quote, which at this point sounds like self-parody. Voting manipulation is no joke, and evidence-based discussions could be useful. But running away with wholly speculative scenarios built on speculative scenarios while hand-wringing about hysteria and mass rallies isn't informative. It's just cynical fear-mongering. And finally, when Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman asked security guards at the Dakota Access Pipeline construction project why they were using pepper spray and dogs to attack Native American protesters, the guards backed off, taking their mace and attack dogs with them. It was a clear lesson in how journalism can defend the rights of citizens. The state of North Dakota had a response to this kind of journalism. It issued a warrant for Goodman's arrest, charging her with criminal trespassing. This is an extraordinary action. Jack McDonald, a lawyer for the North Dakota Newspaper Association and for the Bismarck Tribune, told the Tribune that in 40 years of doing media law in the state, he's never heard of a reporter being charged with trespassing. So, how did journalists respond to one of their own being threatened with arrest for doing her job? Mostly, they ignored it. The story was covered locally in the Bismarck Tribune and the Duluth News Tribune. It was covered internationally in the British Guardian and in a mention in the Toronto Star. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's representative on freedom of the media and the Committee to Protect Journalists issued statements. But most national U.S. outlets, the ones who complain about not getting a seat on a candidate's plane, breathed not a word on North Dakota's assault on the press's ability to cover a major story of the moment. The internet-based Salon and Mashable deserve credit as exceptions. Elite media coverage of a million issues makes clear that they don't mind taking sides. It's a real shame they won't take the side of the right to do journalism when and where it matters. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Thousands of prisoners in some 24 states engaged in a work strike September 9th, protesting their forced labor for no or little pay, along with a number of other dangerous and unhealthy conditions and practices that confront the more than 2 million people incarcerated in the United States. Corporate media could barely have shown less interest. One CBS report, an AP story, and some local accounts in Florida and Alabama were about it as we tape on September 15th. The U.S., we're told, is engaged in a newly serious conversation about mass incarceration. Leave it to elite media to think they can host that conversation without talking to incarcerated people. Joining us to talk about the strike and the issues behind it is Noelle Hanrahan. She's an investigative journalist, a private investigator, and the director of the multimedia production studio Prison Radio. She joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Noelle Hanrahan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, invoking slavery to describe prison labor, as we've heard some inmate organizers do, is not metaphor, really. The 13th Amendment outlawed slavery in 1865, quote, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, close quote. What are some of the work conditions and other conditions that striking prisoners were hoping to direct attention to?
I think we really have to realize that all of the prison systems in this country are based on prison labor. They couldn't run without the prisoners. So 98% of all the work done to maintain these extensive housing projects, this vast amount of public housing really, is done by prisoners. And that's the main work. There are other companies that come in and use workers, but it's not the main problem. The main problem is the warehousing of a workforce. So people are targeted for mass incarceration in this country like no other country in the world. One in 99 people are in prison. One in 46 people will do prison time. And if you add in race, one in three black men will do prison time. So the economy is targeting people by race, by class, and by place. What they need humanely, education, resources, work, jobs, and a society that provides for everyone.
Well, it's interesting that you're talking about the prison as an economy, which is certainly the frame of this strike, but I think it may be a new way of seeing it for some people. The Free Alabama movement is key here as prison organizers, and the co-founder, Kinetic Justice, made exactly this point that he said, we tried petitioning the courts. We tried appealing to legislators about our conditions. You know, we wrote letters. We did all of that with the political process, and it didn't work. And we realized that this is an economic enterprise. And so now we're organizing around our labor.
There are two ways of looking at it. One is, say if you're outside of prisons, every single budget decision in local, state, county, federal, is based almost entirely on what we're spending for our prisons. We make a choice. We're spending money on prisons and warehousing people or preschools. I mean, the same could be said about war as well. But these are two huge ticket items, right? Now, the other thing is, inside prisons, there's a vast amount of people, millions, 2 million, you know, local cities and jails and county jails. We're talking about in a place where people are oppressed and that the conditions that they suffer are extreme and are very biased, very, very, very akin to slavery. If people refuse to go to work, if they refuse to get in line, if they refuse to do those simplest things, they are often brutalized in the extreme. And they are often put in isolation and control units and holes. Almost every single institution in the United States has a segregation unit that is used as a punishment unit. They use calorie reduction. Many of the hunger strikes that we've seen and some of the other protests that we've seen were based on penalties for limited calories, that they were actually taking people's food and visits and clothing.
And you're making the point that it's an economic issue inside the prison, then also an economic issue for the local area in which that prison is situated.
The bodies of prisoners are commodities, and we can see this in a number of ways. When upstate or rural areas have prisons situated in them, they get added representation, added congresspeople. Now, the prisoners are barred from voting, but the communities where those prisoners are warehoused and stored have added representation. So that's just one clear example of how they commodify bodies of prisoners.
Well, I did want to note this one report on CBS Money Watch by Amy Peachy, which was substantive, and there were, as I say, a few other pieces. But really, if people heard about this story, they heard about it from people communicating outside of and around the corporate media. And I guess I find that both frustrating and hopeful. You have been doing the work around this set of issues for many years now. Do you see improvement or change in media's attention to the rights of the incarcerated?
I think that the issue is so dominant within the culture because there are so many people who are incarcerated, you really can't not see it. Then also internationally, we're still out of step. I mean, it's really unprecedented worldwide, the kind of incarceration that we have. Nobody else does it this way. And also in the past 30 to 40 years, we've experienced an incarceration boom. Now, in fact, many of these policies are criminogenic. They create crime. So it's really a vicious cycle that we have to get out of. And I think what we need more of is we need more of a bright, white, hot spotlight shined on these issues. And we have been missing that from the press, because of probably the destruction of investigative newsrooms, mm-hmm. and also courageous legislators. I went to get a master's in criminal justice at Boston University because I was so distressed at the trajectory of what was happening. And in those courses, we never once studied anything outside of the U.S. It was all about fixing this broken system. And I think we have to actually look around because no one does it like this. We have more violence and we have more crime, and we have the highest per capita imprisonment population in the world. And we need a trend toward abolition. We need a trend toward restorative justice. This trend that we've been experiencing for the last 40 years has to go dramatically in the reverse for the health of the society.
The strike didn't just bubble up, of course. It was organized over a period of time. There has been written down calls to action from various groups, model legislation, as we say. It was scheduled for the 45th anniversary of the Attica uprising. We can expect to see more of this kind of action, do you think, from prisoners?
You know, where you oppress people and where there is bias and behavior that's fundamentally immoral, where there's a lack of health care, where there are people dying in infirmaries in prison, you're going to see resistance. And you're going to see people really taking steps to further their own human dignity and express themselves. So this is not going to stop. It's going to be led by the inside. People inside prison are going to lead this. And it's been going all the way across the country. I mean, it's been happening all over. We saw the hunger strikes in California. We saw strikes in Ohio. We saw strikes in Wisconsin. It is not going to stop because people will demand their freedom.
We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan. Noelle Hanrahan, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Wells Fargo employees illegally opened some 2 million accounts in the name of customers who didn't authorize them but were still charged with fees. Employees say the bank set aggressive goals for cross-selling its products, goals on which bonuses and jobs depend. But CEO John Stumpf tells the Wall Street Journal, quote, "there was no incentive to do bad things," close quote. Well, they say the fraud was concentrated in one division and more than 5,000 employees have been fired. But the $185 million fine from regulators is still less than the $200 million worth of stock Stumpf holds and only a little more than the retirement package given the executive in charge of the division identified as the epicenter of abuse. So how does that incentive system work again? We're joined now by former financial regulator William Black. He's associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He joins us now by phone from Vermont. Welcome back to Counterspin, Bill Black.
Thank you.
Well, Adam Davidson in The New Yorker puts it together kind of tightly just by saying Cross-selling gained Wells Fargo enormous amounts of money, as well as praise and envy from its rivals in the banking industry. The fines against the bank are just a tiny fraction of the profits they earned. The message seems quite clear. Encourage aggressive cross-selling at all costs, even if it leads to some fraud. Is there something missing there? Is there a reason that that is not a fairly good assessment of what's going on here?
We'd be lucky if it were only that, because there's no historical context given.
Right.
And the historical context is that we had just seen in the United Kingdom for at least a decade, and the number of people think it's lasted at least two decades, something that was created by exactly the same kind of mechanism, where you would make much more money if you cheated, and you would get potentially fired and certainly reprimanded, lose pay, if you refuse to do the wrong thing. So in the UK, what they did was cross-sell what they called payment protection insurance, and that was to regular customers. And then if you were a small business person, what they did was cross-sell a complex financial derivative, the insurance product. The bank then immediately turned around and sold and got 80 cents on the dollar immediately and transferred all the liability to another company. It involved over 50 billion pounds in the scam sales. It was the entire source of profits for British retail banking for at least a decade and maybe two decades. So this is the biggest deal in cross-selling. This is what Wells Fargo's senior executives would have known would be the inevitable result of these perverse incentives. And to state the obvious, when you're talking about over 5,000 people and the magnitude of just complete fraud with these 2 million accounts plus other credit cards in very large numbers being scammed, you know that it's not a few rotten apples. And the response of the CEO of Wells Fargo to attempt to blame this entirely on the low-level people, to blatantly lie and say there was no incentive to do this when there were powerful incentives created by him and by his senior manager, who, as you said, is going to get a golden parachute as opposed to a jail cell, is outrageous.
And to bring it to media, I find it so galling that you can have a reporter who will quote Stumpf saying there was no incentive. The same reporter will then find employees who say there absolutely was incentive. I guess what I resent is the failure not only to then go back to Stumpf and say, look, we've been talking to your employees and they say you're not telling the truth about this, but the broader media failure to just take on board, to just integrate into the analysis, the demonstrated fact that CEOs lie. You know, when do we get to say that companies need to be not just chided, but actually checked?
Well, they need more, right? This is not the first time this has happened.
Right.
This is absolutely serial criminality from the largest, most elite financial institutions in America. And when will the reporter write, Wells Fargo, comma, a criminal enterprise, comma, did the following new crime?
Well, regulators tend to crow about fines. The $100 million exacted by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they're presenting that as historic. But a lot of people are, I think, unsurprisingly disappointed. They had high hopes for that agency in particular. What is there to say about the role of regulators here?
Compared to the other financial regulators that more directly regulate banks, safety and soundness, it is true this, the CFPB is, you know, in the valley of the blind, the one-eyed agency is king or queen.
Right.
They are the best of a really sad lot. But as as you say, it isn't simply the dollar amount. In fact, that's not the principal criticism. The principal criticism is that the agency did not require any admissions.
So no one had to admit wrongdoing.
That is correct. And no one personally was held responsible. As you said, I was a former financial regulator. I'm a white-collar criminologist. I have negotiated these kinds of things. It's really simple to get a settlement that has a seemingly large dollar amount. Because here's the incentive structures of the CEO. One, I don't go to jail. Two, I don't lose my job. Three, I don't lose any of my income getting clawed back because of the massive fraud. But four is actually, I don't want to have any of my major officers convicted because they might turn on me and testify against me. Conversely, I'm quite willing to have money in fines because they're not going to be paid by me or any of the officers. We'll all walk away rich. All the money will come from the shareholders. So this is an easy trade-off, right? If you're the CEO, I'll be happy to settle to a what sounds like a significant dollar amount. As the press coverage you read me and your listeners earlier said, it's actually not even that big compared to the gains in this case, but it sounds large to the general audience. This has been the symbol of our response to this entire crisis. No one elite is held personally responsible. They walk away wealthy.
And on that note, it feels like a terrible joke being played on, you know, I started to say banking consumers, but unless you keep it in your mattress, it's really every person who's trying to hold on to and have access to their money. It seems like a joke when politicians stand up and say, well, let's make sure this never happens again.
Well, it does. And I really strongly recommend that people view the most recent Michael Moore movie, Where Will We Invade Next? And look at the experience of Iceland. In Iceland, the people said, we are not going to put up with this. We're going to go into the streets and demand specific changes. And in two cases since the crisis, they have caused the government of Iceland to fall within 72 hours.
We've been speaking with William Black of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His book is The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. It's out now in an updated edition. William Black, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.